So what is a system call? There is the old way of doing it by doing an interrupt 8.0, or we can do a fast call or syscall or sysenter through the Linux gate. And that's going to be a more modern approach. But for legacy support, the older way with int 8.0 is still supported. So it's easier. Therefore, that's what we'll take a look at here. And a system call allows us to communicate between ring 3 and ring 0. It's how we go through the gate and get into supervisor mode context. So of course, just like I showed you on the screen a moment ago with the syscall page that I just randomly looked up on Google, we need to understand the system call that we wish to call and how those arguments need to be set up. So let's get right to it. We want to spawn a root shell. That's what we're going to walk through the shell code for. And many programs drop privs. So therefore, we need to restore privileges to UID 0 so that we can execute things as root. Other problems may arise as well, so let's just get to it. So this shellcode you see on the screen is shellcode that I wrote with comments on the right, but this shellcode's been written a million times. This is nothing unique. But I intentionally wrote it on this slide so that it's got problems. I want it to break so you can see a common problem that arises with shellcode. Now if you start at the top there, it says move into EAX 0. This is Intel syntax, the way it should be. So move into EAX 0. And then the next set, we're basically moving null bytes into all of those registers you see, AX, BX, CX, and DX. Now, the first thing we're going to be doing is calling syscall number 70, which is the set REUID function, or syscall. That is the, we want to change the effective user ID. We want to restore privileges, basically. So we want to move 0 into BX, CX, and DX to serve as the argument that corresponds with UID 0. So if you're looking at a set UID binary and it's owned by root, that'd be great. That's what you want to do. But if you're looking at a set UID binary that's owned by user ID 1002 and you're trying to restore privileges to 0, it's not going to work, right? So you got to take that into account. So we're moving at towards the bottom of that first block, 46, which is 70 in decimal, into EAX, because that's going to serve as a syscall number that we wish to make for set REUID. And we've got all the arguments set up accordingly. And then at the bottom, we've got interrupt 8.0. When we send that syscall interrupt, it's going to expect to see the syscall number in the accumulator register. And that's why we put it there. And then the arguments accordingly. So if that works, then we would have restored privileges. And then we get to the bottom block, which is what we really want to do, and spawn a shell. So we want to make a call to syscall number 11, which is execve. So towards the bottom of that block, that's why you see we're removing 0b into the accumulator register and then doing the interrupt. But starting at the top of that block, we're zeroing out the accumulator register again. That's very common with shellcode. We zero out the accumulator register to know what state it's in at the beginning. Then we push EDX. Well, EDX still holds a null byte from the prior block. So we're pushing a null byte onto the stack to terminate that string you see afterward. There's two push instructions. That's the ASCII hex for /bin/sh. And that's what we want syscall number 11, execve, to execute. So we push it on the stack. And then you can see we're moving into the BX register, the stack pointer. And that block there, that block of code, the push EDX, push ESP, we are setting up the registers so that they compensate and handle the argument vector and the environmental pointer. We're just making sure everything points to the way it should. And one way to test this and to know where these things should be pointing is write a little C program, and in that C program, make a call to that function and then compile it, set a breakpoint on the call to that function, and take a look at the registers in the stack and just know that you've got a replicate that in your assembly code when you're writing shellcode. So that's pretty much it. There's not really much to this shellcode. If you look at Linux shellcode, it's typically much smaller than Windows shellcode, and there's a really good reason for that that we'll cover in Book 5. But that's all it takes to spawn a shell on a Linux system. So pretty simple. But there's going to be problems. We're going to use the tool NetWide Assembler, NASM, to assemble this shellcode. And it supports x86 and 64-bit as well. And it will compile it or assemble it into a ELF binary for us, or ELF formatted. So we go in and use NASM. The top command on the screenshot says NASM, and then we call that shellcode file setRUID shellcode with nulls.s. That's going to assemble it for us. And then we're using XXD on the next line down, minus PS for PostScript, and that way it just dumps out the hex. And when we dump out the hex, that's our actual shellcode, and you can see that there's all these null bytes in there. Those null bytes are there because if we go back to the shellcode, look what we're doing, moving zero into a 32-bit register. So that's going to result in 00000000 as the argument to load into the accumulator register. Look at the second to last one on the top block where it says move into EAX hex 46. That's going to result in 00000046 because it's a 32-bit register. So that's why all those null bytes are showing up. So we need to fix that because we don't want null bytes because they're string terminators. It might have caused problems with code execution. Also, it's larger than it needs to be. Think about what we need to do. We need those registers to hold zeros, but we don't necessarily need to use an instruction that results in 4-byte operand of zeros. We can do it a different way. And I know some of you are already thinking, yeah, we could XOR it. If we XOR a register with itself, that's going to result in a null double word being in that register, but it's not going to put any null bytes into our shell code because we're going to be using an opcode that nullifies or nulls it out or zeros it out, whatever you want to call it, but it's not going to result in null bytes in the shell code. And that's what we want. And there's different ways we can do that. And you see some of them up here. In the bottom section, there's that XOR the register with itself. There's subtracting something from itself will result in a null. Moving from a register that holds a null byte into a register that needs one. Incrementing and decrementing could be useful. Imagine if we said pop off the stack FFFFFFFF, right? That's negative one. It's all F's. And we pop it off the stack into the EAX register. And then we simply say increment EAX by one. Increment EAX is going to be a 1-byte opcode, and it's going to increment the negative one to zero, resulting in a zero in that register. But we don't have any zeros in our shellcode. And different ways we can do it. Up at the top there goes to that other example where we're moving 0A into EAX. That's going to leave three sets of null bytes. It's going to be 00000000A. Instead, we can reference that lower byte register. Remember, we talked about that in the first module of Book 4. Move 0A into AL. That's accumulator low. And that will get rid of those null bytes in the front, at least in the shellcode. So here is the corrected or fixed shellcode. You can see I use some of these examples we just talked about. Instead of moving zero into a 32-bit register, we're XORing, we're subtracting, we're moving from one register to another, we're moving hex 46 into AL, which is a 1-byte register. When we do that and we assemble it, now we have none of those null bytes that we had before, and the shellcode is much smaller. So what we would do at this point is take our shellcode and put it into this little program here. Someone named Luca came up with this little tiny bit of code here, but it's really cool code because if you put your shell code into that S code, little buffer array up there, you can compile this, and at runtime, it will convert that S code variable into a function, and it will call and execute what you've put in there. So it's a way of testing your shell code. So let's go over to a VM here. And in this VM, I've got that ready to go. If I say cat scode1.c, you can see there is the shellcode that we just talked about. Now, in this example, it looks like a different example that I have loaded in there because I've got null bytes in there. So let's go and disassemble the one that I'd already compiled. So if we say ls minus la scode1, the compiled version. Now, this says owned by deadlist and read, write, execute. What we'd want to do is set the ownership to root and set the set UID bit to see if the shellcode actually works. Let me see if I didn't actually screw this up here and run it. Scode one. You can see we get a regular user mode shell, right? So it shows you it's working, but we want to make sure it sets the permissions and everything accordingly. So I'm going to quit out of there. We're going to say sudo minus I And as root, I'm going to say change ownership to root, root slash home dead list S code one. So now it's owned by root. And then we're also going to change permissions. So chmod plus S home dead list S code one. And now we should have set the set UID bit. So ls minus la. And there you can see it is owned by root and the set UID bit is set. Set UID bit, of course, again, means that if we run that program, it'll run under the context of the owner as opposed to me. Okay, so let's go in and test the shellcode and disassemble it. So gdb scode one. And then now we're going to say disassemble main. And right towards the bottom there, you can see the call to the pointer in EAX. We're going to set a breakpoint there. That's when the S code variable that's been turned into a function is being called. So we'll say break asterisk that run. We hit the breakpoint step instruction. And now we're in the S code function. So first I'm going to change my disassembly flavor. So we'll say set disassembly flavor to Intel and then X slash 16i examines 16 instructions starting at the instruction pointer. And what's on the screen there should look real familiar. That's exactly what our shellcode looked like before we actually assembled it with NASM. So what you'd want to do then, if this was maybe, again, new shellcode you hadn't seen before and you were wondering what it's going to do, look for the interrupts, the system calls, and then look at the system call number that's being made. And you'd be able to look that up in the static table and say, okay, 4.6, that's 70, that's set REUID. Down here, you can say, oh, it looks like we're calling execve. And then you could go and look at this string by saying something like examine string at that location. And you can see slash bin slash shell kind of hidden in there. So just a simple little trick you can use to, again, look at shellcode to make sure to see and make sure it's doing what it says it's going to do. All right, so that wraps up our module on shellcode. And again, it's just to get you started to kind of see if you wanted to head down this direction and write your own shellcode. That's a couple of the things that you'd want to do and pick up. So we looked at the basics. We looked at system call tables and how they're static on Linux, how you can remove null bytes and some other problems you might run into. And then, of course, finished up with how you might be able to go and test shellcode. Okay, so let's go in and test the shellcode and disassemble it. So gdb S code one. And then now we're going to say disassemble main. And right towards the bottom there, you can see the call to the pointer in EAX. We're going to set a breakpoint there. That's when the S code variable that's been turned into a function is being called. So we'll say break asterisk that run. We hit the breakpoint step instruction. And now we're in the S code function. So first I'm going to change my disassembly flavor. So we'll say set disassembly flavor to Intel, and then X slash 16i examines 16 instructions starting at the instruction pointer. And what's on the screen there should look real familiar. That's exactly what our shellcode looked like before we actually assembled it with NASM. So what you'd want to do then, if this was maybe, again, new shellcode you hadn't seen before and you were wondering what it's going to do, look for the interrupts, the system calls, and then look at the system call number that's being made. And you'd be able to look that up in the static table and say, okay, 4.6, that's 70, that's set REUID. Down here, you can say, oh, it looks like we're calling execve. And then you could go and look at this string by saying something like examine string at that location. And you can see slash bin slash shell kind of hidden in there. So just a simple little trick you can use to, again, look at shellcode to make sure to see and make sure it's doing what it says it's going to do. All right, so that wraps up our module on shellcode. And again, it's just to get you started to kind of see if you wanted to head down this direction and write your own shellcode. That's a couple of the things that you'd want to do and pick up. So we looked at the basics. We looked at system call tables and how they're static on Linux, how you can remove null bytes and some other problems you might run into. And then, of course, finished up with how you might be able to go and test shellcode. We're now going to begin the section on smashing the stack. So this is the module where we'll walk through our first buffer overflow on Linux. Now, this one's going to have no protections, so no data execution prevention or ASLR or canaries or anything protecting it. And the reason for that is it's good to see what it looks like with none of those protections added, and then we'll start adding those protections on so we can see the difference between how it was and how it is. And then we'll look at ways to try and circumvent or get around those protections. So that's going to be our initial focus. We'll get to an exercise pretty quickly. How this will work, at least for this section, is I'm going to introduce the concept, and then I'll do a walkthrough, and then I'll hand it over to you to work through the exercise. So it's a little bit reversed from some of the other sections where we may show you how the exercise works in a walkthrough, but after, because this time it's going to be kind of the other way, where we do it first, and then you're going to go do it on your own. You still have the option, of course, to stop the recording at any point before I get started with the actual demo portion and try it on your own if that's the path you wish to choose. Completely up to you, and you can always obviously go back and forth. So our objective for this module, we want to identify a privileged program that is one with the set UID bit set. We then want to go and identify a buffer overflow opportunity. We want to get control of the instruction pointer, redirect execution, and get code execution on the stack. Then in the same module, we'll have a second exercise and concept known as return to libc. And that's a technique that we can use to get around data execution prevention if it is on by just avoiding it. So we'll get to that soon. So note on operating system versions, you'll notice if you look at the course USB that you've got a Kubuntu Precise Pangolin VM, and you've got another one called Kubuntu Gutsy Gibbon. And the reason for that is different operating system or kernel versions have different inherent problems with them. And you'll see what is meant by that when we get to a section on ASLR bypass. And I'll bring this back up again. But we jump around different operating systems on Linux because of that. And also in the real world, in the world of Unix and Linux, you see tons of distributions, all the IoT products out there and just different flavors that people are using inside organizations or at home. So you'll end up needing to have an understanding of many different types. Also, like it says on the slide, to learn math, would you start with calculus? Probably not. You need to start with basic math, work your way up into algebra and onward. You can't just start without having any concept or understanding of mathematics with calculus. So it's similar here, where you can't just jump onto a Gen 2 Linux box with GR security locking it down, or you can't just jump onto a Windows 10 Enterprise operating system with Exploit Guard running. You need to know the basics before you work your way up into that and then ramp up quickly. So we'll talk in Book 5 about exploit mitigation specifically. There's a module there that we will take some time to go through the different categories of mitigations, like compile time mitigations or OS protections, and different ways around them and how effective different ones are. All right, so let's get started on this stack exploitation. The goals of Stack Overflow is obviously anything you want your shellcode to do. So bypassing authentication and getting code redirection, getting a shell, getting an interpreter shell running, or other, adding a user account. Your username and password on the Linux distributions is deadlist, deadlist, and a deadlisting is a binary that's been disassembled. It's called a deadlisting because it's not running. So that will be your username and password for the two primary Kubuntu distros that you'll be using in this book. So you probably remember a bit of this from Book 2, where if we want to find a program that has a set UID bit set, because that would be one of interest. Obviously, if it's owned by someone else and a set UID bit is set, that means it's going to run under the context of the owner. And if there's a vulnerability, that would mean that we can get code execution as that other user account, which obviously may be a good thing from our perspective. So like I said a moment ago, this I'm going to walk through everything first and then hand it over to you. So this is the exercise. This is where you will start. But like I said at the bottom, I'm going to go through it first. And we may change it up at times as I go through the other demos throughout the book. But our goals here, we want to identify the vulnerability as a little POC program, proof of concept. And we want to identify the vulnerability. We want to determine the buffer size. We want to verify control of the instruction pointer and get some shellcode execution. So this program is called password, and this is just showing you the command uname minus rs to determine the kernel version that's running on. This one's 3.2. It's in your home deadlist directory. Again, we're using precise pangolin 12.04 for this particular exercise. And when you run the program, you can see here with the Python command a times 1000, it is causing a segmentation fault. So let's jump over to the VM and start going through this. And we'll go back and forth between the slides. So I am on my precise pangolin VM. And just verify. There you can see. Actually, I'm not on the right one, and that's why I checked. So I'm glad I did. I might have been doing this demo on the wrong version. So uname minus rs, and there we're on the right one. All right, so if we run the password program, it prompts us and says, please enter a password. We put a bunch of A's in. It says access denied. So it's not, it's proof of concept. Doesn't really do anything exciting. But if we do a ls minus la on it, you can see it's owned by root with the set UID bit set. So if there's a vulnerability, we can exploit and get control as root. So let's go in and now try entering a lot more A's. So we'll run the program and we just hold down the A key for a while and it just says access denied. So we could keep doing it that way, but instead we're going to run a Python command. So Python minus C print A times, let's do 1000. And then we're going to pipe that in as input to the password program. And you can see it says segmentation fault. So that means we caused the problem by sending in 1000 A's, and we're going to want to investigate that further. Well, we want to determine how many bytes does it take to cause the crash. So we could do it this more, clever way of doing it. This is kind of more of a trial and error brute force approach that's probably not the best option, but it might work. So let's try that first, and then we'll look at some other ways to do this. So it crashed at 1,000. Does it crash at 500? No, it doesn't. Does it crash at 700? Yes, it does. You can see the segmentation fault. 600? No. So now we're splitting the difference, right? How about 620? It crashes. 608? It crashes. 604, it doesn't crash. So right around 608 bytes is where it's causing the problem. So we can just remember that for now. One better option might be to use the pattern create and pattern offset scripts from Metasploit. So let me look at the VMs that I have up right now and see if I've got one that's going to work here. So I'll just go to this Kali Linux VM over here. Thought I had one running. Where did it go? There it is right here. So I'll go to this one here, and I'm going to say locate pattern create.rb, and you can see it's in my Metasploit directory. So I'm just going to go to that directory, user, share, Metasploit framework, tools, and pattern create.rb. If I just run pattern create.rb, it says missing argument. So let's say minus h. It wants us to give it minus L for length and then specify the length of the pattern. So we'll run this again. So pattern create minus length. Let's do 700. And what this is doing is it's producing a unique pattern. Now, if we run this command three times, the pattern will always be the same. And the idea behind it is if we change it to 704 and then 708, the pattern will still be the same all the way up to that offset, and then it will be a completely unique portion of the pattern. And if we can cause a crash to occur in the debugger with the program, some of that pattern should end up in a processor register. And then we can use the pattern offset script, give it the portion of the pattern that shows up in the register, and it will tell us how far into the pattern, how many bytes into the pattern overall, does that piece of the pattern exist? And that will help tell us the buffer size, right? So I'm going to go ahead and grab this, and hopefully it'll let me copy and paste at a target. And we're going to go on with the debugger. So we're in there. Now, first thing I'm going to do is cause it to crash with just the A so you can see what happens. So we'll say run, and I'll use this weird syntax here that lets me put in a Python command, Python minus C print A times 700. And you can see that segmentation fault occurred, and we've got 41414141, which is a hexadecimal ASCII value for capital A. And if we do it info registers, You can see our A's are ending up all over the place, but most importantly, in that instruction pointer. So clearly we have a buffer overflow condition. But that doesn't help us determine the buffer size by itself. So if we put the pattern in now, let's change this. Hopefully it lets me paste it. Good, it does. And then we run it again. Now you can see this shows up. That's a piece of the pattern. So we're going to grab that value, go back over to our Kali system, and I'm going to say pattern offset minus Q for query, and then paste in that piece of the pattern. So watch what it comes back with. 612. So remember, we got 608, 612 when we did it the manual way. So this gave us pretty much the same answer. Now, the final way that we'll do this is by reverse engineering. So let's say disassemble, actually first off, info functions. And you can see there's a function called main. And we saw earlier, main calls check PW for check password, and check password calls granted if we successfully authenticate. So I'm going to grab this check password function and just say disassemble check password and dump that out. Now, the vulnerability is due to this gets function. Gets is one of those banned functions that should never be used, just like stir copy. It doesn't do any length checking or bounds checking. So in other words, if we allocate 100 bytes in a buffer and then we use the get string function to copy data into that buffer, it doesn't validate the size or the length. So we could give it as much as we want and it will happily just overwrite that buffer, getting us control of that return pointer that we talked about previously. So if we look above that, it says load the effective address -260 hex from the base pointer into EAX. Then write that address to the top of the stack and then call gets. That's setting up the argument for where gets should write to a destination. So again, we're going in saying base pointer is pointing at the save frame pointer. What's -hex260? What's the address of that? Put that into the accumulator register, write it to the top of the stack, and that's writing the data into the buffer. So that's how it's determining that. So all we have to do is take this 260, convert it to decimal, and we'll be able to get the buffer size. So to do that, we could just say shell, try Python minus C print 0x260, and it comes back and says 608. So 608, there's that number again. So let's validate if that's true. We should be able to get control of the instruction pointer very precisely, right? So we'll say run, and then Python minus C print A times 612. Now the buffer size is 608, but remember there's in between the buffer and the return pointer is that saved frame pointer. So that's where we're adding four more bytes to be 612. Plus, I'll put in dead code like that. And I put it in Little Endian format. You'll see why soon, but it's a Little Endian architecture, so we need to write the bytes in reverse order because they get written in the opposite direction. So we run that, and you can see we got dead code in the instruction pointer. So info, reg, EIP, dead code. So we determined that we definitely got a buffer overflow on the stack, and we calculated how large the buffer is three different ways. So with that, now that we know what the buffer sizes and we've proven to get control of the instruction pointer, what do we want to do next? One option is to redirect execution. So if we disassemble the check PW function and we go to the bottom down here, notice that there's a call to granted right there. That's what we want to get to. We want to bypass authentication and call granted even if we don't know the password. So up at the, a little bit higher than that, it says repeat until zero, compare string one byte at a time, EDI, ESI. Remember we talked about that when we, in the first module to, in this book. And that's a string comparison. That's what's actually checking the passwords. And if those are equal, if it's a match, it'll set the zero flag to a one. And then when we hit this instruction down here, jump if not equal, we won't take the jump. We'll call granted. If we're not equal, we're going to skip over granted and we're going to exit out. So by overwriting that return pointer, instead of with dead code, with the address of the call to granted, we should be able to bypass authentication via the buffer overflow. So let's try that out. Instead of putting dead code in, we're going to put in that address. Now, here's where Little Endian will become obvious. If I write it in the order you think you would normally write it in. So 08 and then 04, 84, EE. That's in big Endian format. Watch what happens. We crash and look at the address it crashes on. EE840408. Because of Little Endian architecture, it writes the bytes we put in reverse order. So we need to write it in reverse so it puts it in the right order that we want. So let's change that up. And we say EE840408. And this time when we run it, we get access granted. It still crashes because it doesn't know where to return to after that, but we bypass authentication this way. So with that being said, we pretty much prove that we've got a buffer overflow and we can control the process, but now we want to get code execution of our shell code. So we're going to have to do a little bit more work this time. So I'm going to drop down to a shell by typing shell, and then when we exit out of the shell, we'll be back in the debugger. And I'm going to cat a file called shellcode.txt. And there's a couple different shellcode pieces in here. I want to scroll up and this top one here, it says Linux IE32 bind, L port 9999, size 84 bytes. So this is set up to copy and paste into like a script. Below that is the command line version, which I'm going to take. So we know it's 84 bytes and it's going to pop a shell. It's going to open a shell and bind it to port 9999. So we'll grab that and I'm going to exit out of here. Now we don't know where we're going to tell the return pointer to go to yet. So I'm just going to put an RRRR to serve as my return pointer. And I'm going to first put in a NOPSLED. So hex 90. Now NOPSLED's been around forever, and the idea behind it is, I'll give a silly example. If you ever watch an old cartoon like Bugs Bunny, where Bugs Bunny would jump off the roof of a building and land in a little pint glass of water and be completely fine. That's some serious precision there, right? I'd much rather, if I have to jump off a building, land on a huge landing pad, some of those inflatable things. That's kind of what we're doing here. If we use this opcode and we say, send that opcode in times 300, then we're putting a big landing pad. And as long as we overwrite the return pointer with an address that falls anywhere within that landing pad, when the processor goes to execute 90, that interprets it as a NOP or no op. It says no operation, no operation. We keep executing that until we slide down to our shell code. So now we've got our NOPs and we say plus. I'm going to paste in the shell code now. And there's that. So now we're at 384 bytes because the shell code's 84 bytes. So 384 from 612 is 228. So we'll say plus. I'll just put A times 228. Now, some people might opt to run the shell code directly up to the return pointer override, and that's not recommended because there's a lot more code that has to execute before we get control. If you remember, we say disassemble check PW, the gets call where we get the buffer overflow is pretty early on in the code. There's like 30, 40 more lines of code to execute before we get to that ret instruction that actually gets us to control. So the buffer overflow, the overwrite's much earlier, and it's not till the procedure epilogue when we get the actual control. So any of those lines of code could cause a problem, and it could have overwritten something in our shell code. And it just so happens that that's more likely to occur the closer you get down to the return pointer. So I'm going to leave this here now. We've got 300 NOPs, 84 bytes of shell code, 228 bytes of A's to get us to the return pointer offset. And right now we've got RRRR. So it's going to crash. We'll run it. Here we get 52525252. That's capital R in ASCII hex. Now, if we want to, we could examine memory at this point and look back up in memory, or we could go and set a breakpoint. So let's set a breakpoint. And I'm going to set it right after the call to gets. So the address right after the call to gets will be right when the data is copied. So that if we examine the stack pointer at that moment in time, we should see our NOPSLED and everything because it had just been copied by the gets function. So let's set a breakpoint there. Break 804.848a. And then we'll run this again. Hit the breakpoint. X for examine. 20WX. So dump it out in hexadecimal. Starting from the stack pointer. And there you can see that NOPSLED. If we scroll down, if we keep hitting enter, you see the shell code followed by the padding all the way down to the return pointer overwrite. Now, how do we know that we've properly overwritten the return pointer, even though we've seen it already? Remember, the base pointer always points to the save frame pointer, and right below the save frame pointer is the return pointer. So we could always issue a command like x/wx EBP +4, and there's the return pointer position. So we can see that we've successfully overwritten it. We can also say BT for backtrace, and that will show us the return pointers back to the callers as well. So either way, we're just validating that again. So let's dump out the stack again. So we could land theoretically anywhere in this NOP sled, and it should work. It doesn't mean it will work, but it should work. I'm going to point code execution down to these last four NOPs here. And since we're on the screen, let's talk about the addressing layout. So see how we're at BFFFF170? That's the address on the stack where this data is stored. So that BFFFF170 corresponds to that byte on the right because of little endian. So BFFFF170, this would be 7-1, that would be 7-2, and then that would be 7-3. Then over here on the next double word, starting from the right, would be 7-4, 5-6-7, and then 8-9-A-B-C-D-E-F. So just keep in mind that that's how the addressing works. So if I go and overwrite the return pointer with BFFFF170 in this case, we should execute this first NOP here, being a total of four NOPs, and then slide to our shell code. Now, ASLR is not on, so the addressing should be relatively consistent, but it may not be exact. The longer you have your system in an up state and other factors may change the memory a little bit, but overall it should be pretty consistent and static. But it may vary or differ a little bit from my screen or from the book. That's just the way it works. So we're going to overwrite that return pointer instead of RRRR with that stack address. So hex 70 F1 FF BF. And we run it. We hit the breakpoint. This is right after the data was copied into memory. So we can do a backtrace, and we can see we successfully overwrote the return pointer with that stack address. Now let's set one more breakpoint on the RET instruction so we can see that execute. So we'll say disassemble, check PW, go to the very bottom, and set a breakpoint on that RET address. So break 0x804850F, and we'll say C for continue, and we hit the breakpoint. So if I look at the instruction we're pointing to, it's the RET instruction. What are we going to return to? Well, let's see what the stack pointer is pointing to. And it's pointing to the stack address. So if I say SI for step one instruction, it says cannot access memory at address 41414145. That's just EBP complaining, the base pointer complaining, because we overwrote the save frame pointer. So you can just ignore that. But what's the instruction pointer pointing to now? X/8I EIP. You can see there's our last four NOPs followed by our shell code. So if I say C to continue, it's hanging because the port's open. So let's take a look. Netstat minus NAT, grep for 9999, and the port's open. Now we got this executing in the debugger. So if we connect to it, we are just going to be ourselves because debuggers drop your privileges. So we need to try this outside of the debugger. So let's go back over here and And let's control C to kill it. I'm going to grab my input and then we're going to drop out of the debugger. So we'll copy that. Oh, that was weird that it did that. Let's bring that up again. I'm not sure if it copied right. All right, so I'm copying that. And then we'll break out of the debugger. So netstat minus NAT 9999, it's not open anymore because we killed the debugger. Let's paste this in and then pipe that to password. And there it's hanging again. So now we can go back over and see if the port's open, and it is. So we'll say netcat 127.0.0.1, port 9999, and then who am I? Root. So now we are in as root with just a regular old shell, and then we can drop out. So that worked perfectly right out of the box. Let's go out to the slides here. And again, this is the exercise. It walks you through it. It also will tell you hint number one, hint number two, hint number three. It's just trying to encourage you to try on your own. And then the walkthrough is right afterward. That solution, which is pretty much what you saw me just demo, is after that. And if you follow all the commands, it should work as expected. Now, when we get to the end of this, there's a slide that says, why does it only work on some addresses? And some common questions. I'm landing in my NOP sled, but it's breaking. It's not working. Why does it work on some addresses in the NOP sled, but other ones it fails? Why does it work inside the debugger, but not outside, or the other way around? Those are common things you run into. Remember, first off, you're hacking. It's not supposed to work, and you're just trying to make it work. And it could be various factors. Something could be getting clobbered, as I mentioned previously, why you don't want to run your shellcode right up to the return pointer. Clobbering is a term used to describe when a instruction or opcode executes, and for whatever reason, it ends up overwriting something critical that you need. Maybe it overwrote a byte of your shellcode, and now your shellcode is broken, and it causes it to crash. The memory layout inside the debugger may vary differently. Certain types of environment variables may not be getting mapped in, so the memory layout may be slightly off. There might be alignment issues. I put the one up there that says idiosyncrasies in program behavior, which is another way of saying, I have no idea. Sometimes it just doesn't work. And that's why you've got to do trial and error. Try increasing the NOP sled, decreasing the NOP sled, move the shellcode to a different location, and just keep trying. And you should be able to get it to work and have some relative consistency with it. So the point of that exercise is to identify a buffer overflow in a vulnerable Linux binary. And again, this is a technique. We just looked at a POC program that has no exploit mitigations. That's as easy as you can make it. And now we're going to, of course, start increasing the complexity in some of the later challenges here. So one thing we didn't talk about is the strip command. Let me just show you what it does here. First off, on the screen, we've got GNU-C compiler, and it says minus FNO stack protector. That's turning off stack canaries. We'll turn those back on later. Minus Z or Z exec stack. That's turning off DEP support. And then we're compiling that. We're calling it password 2 in this case, and then we say strip password 2. Remember before we said things like dissass main, and it said, sure, I'll just dump out the main function. Well, since we stripped it, it strips off all those internal symbols. And those aren't needed by the process anymore. Those are there for you, for someone debugging. If we strip it, the program works as expected, just fine. So we can strip the internal symbols, which are the internal function names and variable names and such, but we can't strip off any dynamic dependencies. So you see on the bottom right there, info functions still shows us the dependencies this program has. So the question you would ask is, from where in the process is the gets function being called, since I can't say disassemble main and check PW? You can set a breakpoint on the entry of a function in the procedure linkage table like you see on this slide. So break on that address, run it, and when it hits the call to that function that you care about in the procedure linkage table, you then say BT for backtrace like at the bottom, and it shows you 804.848a. If you remember just a little moment ago, that's the breakpoint I set on the address after the gets call so we could see our data copy to memory. So anytime that function of interest gets called, you would hit the breakpoint due to the dynamic dependency, and you can see how you got there. So that's just a little quick way of handling strip programs. So the next technique we're going to look at is return to libc, and it's a bit easier, and it also allows us to get around data execution prevention, which on Linux we call it WXOR execute. It's an exclusive OR. So if it's easier, why wouldn't we just use it? And it gets around DEP? Because with this technique, you are limited to only executing code that exists within a module that's loaded. In other words, if there's a library that's been loaded into the process, you can overwrite the return pointer with the address of a function from that library, and you can get it to execute code. So the limitation is that you can only execute code that's already inside that library. You can't do a return to interpreter with return to libc. So that's the limitation there. But if it does what you need to do, then why not use it? Because again, it gets around DEP, and that's what we're going to talk about here. So you can return to a function in a module within a library, like system. You can return to maybe the procedural linkage table. that's actually a cool little trick, because if ASLR is on, which it will be in a bit, and it's not a PI, a position independent executable, the entries in the procedure linkage table are going to be static. So let's say the system function is utilized in the process. We could return to the static address in the PLT of system, and it will call system for us. So we might be able to get around ASLR that way by avoiding it. So we can really return to anything that's meaningful to us if it accomplishes our goal. So in this exercise, I'm going to walk through it, and then you're going to have a slightly modified challenge, and I'll explain what that is. But we're going to verify that DEP is on for this particular process. We're going to look that the buffer size has changed, and we're going to use the return to libc technique to maintain control. So if we go over to the target here, and we run this pass libc program, it says, I've caught on to you, pal. The buffer's too small. It's non-executable. What are you going to do? So if we enter in this small number of A's in the last program password, this wouldn't have crashed it because it took like 608 plus. You hit enter here, causes a segmentation fault. So clearly the buffer size is smaller. But not only that, if we run this tool called checksec minus minus file and we run it against the password program, you could see it says NX is disabled. That's no execute. That's DEP. If we run it against pass libc, it says NX is enabled. So clearly we can't execute code on the stack. If we wanted to be able to execute code on the stack, we'd have to change permissions. But we're trying to make this particular one easy with return to libc. So instead of overwriting the return pointer with the address of code on the stack, we're going to overwrite the return pointer with an address of a function from a system library that's loaded in the process space. And that's going to be our goal here. So let's go into GDB, and I'm just going to go and disassemble the checkpw function again, and I'll give you a moment. Based on what we learned in the last exercise about how to determine the buffer size, looking at what's on the screen right now, how big is the buffer for this program? And I'll just give you a moment. All right, so if you said 16, you are correct, and how we determine that is, there's that call to gets, and a couple instructions above it, load the effective address of negative 16 from the base pointer into EAX. That's the destination argument. So that is the buffer size, 16 bytes. So if that's true, if we say run, and then we say Python minus C print A times, not 16, because we have to add 4 more bytes for the save frame pointer. So A times 20 plus BBBB, we should expect to see 42424242 in the instruction pointer, and we do. So real quickly, we were able to determine the buffer size there. So now what we want to do is use this return to libc technique. So let me show you the slide again. Right here is the slide I wanted to show you. Okay. And actually, let me draw this up. It's going to be a little bit easier to digest and see. So I'm going to go to my paint process here, and I'm going to draw the stack real quick. So let's say that that's the stack, and at the top is our buffer. Let's put buffer. Now this is 20 bytes. Now right below that would be the save frame. I'm sorry, that was 16 bytes. 16 bytes. Right below that is a save frame pointer, which is 4 more bytes. That's where I got the 20 from. So that's 4 bytes. And we already saw this. After that is the return pointer. What we want to do, instead of overwriting the return pointer with the address in the buffer, we're going to overwrite the return pointer with the address of the system function. Then we're going to put a 4-byte pad. I'll explain why in a moment. And then we're going to put a pointer to a string. This is going to end up being an environment variable. So a pointer to a string. What's going to happen is when the ret instruction executes, it's going to return to the system function, and it's going to expect the argument that it's supposed to execute to be at that offset at plus 4. Why not immediately afterward and where we put the pad. Because think about this. We are returning to a function's entry point. That's not how we normally call a function, right? When we call a function, we use the call instruction. And the call instruction pushes the return pointer on the stack for us. In this case, since we're returning to the start of a function, nobody pushed the return pointer on for us. So this position where we put the pad is where the system function will expect the return pointer to be on the stack. And then the next double word, it's going to expect that to be the argument. So that's why we put the pad in the middle. Now we're going to create an environment variable that simply will be a string that we want to have executed. And then we're going to write the address of that environment variable right at this offset. But that's how the stack layout is going to work. Let's go back in the debugger. And it's a pretty easy technique. So we're in the debugger already. And with the process having already run, so I do info reg, you can see we overwrote the instruction pointer, or we overwrote the return pointer and got control of the instruction pointer with 42424242. I'm going to say print system. What that did, ASLR is not on yet, but what it did is give me the address of the system function. So that's what I want to overwrite the return pointer with. And that's good. That's the return to libc technique. We're returning to the address of the start entry point of a function. And then we put a 4-byte pad, and then we put our argument to system. So we need this piece. So I'm going to drop out of the debugger. And now we're going to create an environment variable. So I'm going to say export. I'll call mine NC for netcat equals netcat.traditional. Because on this system, regular netcat doesn't support the minus E command. Minus listen. Minus port. I'll just choose 7777. Minus execute slash bin slash sh. So there's my environment variable. And there's this little program called env in your home directory. And if you give that an argument of your environment variable, it will tell you relatively where it sits in memory. Remember, environment variables, if we create it in this shell, would not exist if I go to a different shell, like over here. It only exists in the shell where we created it. It's usually 10 bytes off, just the way and how the name of the environment variable will be handled, and it's got an equals and such, and it gets mapped into every process memory. It ends up being 10 bytes off. So if you subtract 10 from what it gave us there, that should be the start point of that environment variable string, nc.traditional. But even if you don't get it precisely, it should be okay, because shell will tell you where you messed up. So it's almost like it's helping you identify and exploit this thing. But now we've got all the pieces. So look how easy the code is now. We type in Python minus C print A times 20. That gets us to the return pointer, right? We're going to overwrite the return pointer with the address of system in little endian format. So slash x 7011061. So that's the address of system plus a 4-byte pad. I'll just put pad in there. That serves as the return pointer when system gets done executing the code. It's going to have to return somewhere, right? Well, whatever you put there is where it's going to return. So you could use the address of something like the exit function so that you exit gracefully. It's up to you. Plus, now we put in our environment variable address. I'm just going to type it in as is. So hex 67, F6, FF, BF. And we'll pipe this as input to the passlibc program. And look what happens. Segmentation fault, but look what shell says. Onal not found. Well, if you remember, echo $NC, onal is part of our command. So see how it's telling us that we're off, which is pretty funny. So if we go in here and change the environment variable address, I'm going to take mine from 67 and drop it down to 62. Now look what it says. Additional not found. So we need to go a little further. So we just keep backing up until we get to the start of the string, or we just count. We're at additional, so we need to subtract 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more bytes. Let's go over here, and we'll subtract from 6, 2. That's going to be 6, 1, 6, 0, FED, so 5D. And now when we run it, it hangs because the port opened. So we go over here, netstat, look for 7777, and it's open, so we should be able to connect to it. And we're root again. So a pretty easy technique to get around data execution prevention. Now, I'm sure some of you are thinking, well, Does that mean I have to be local on the system in order to create an environment variable so this won't work remotely across a network connection? And yes, you don't have the ability to create an environment variable, but what you can do is maybe the process has a string of interest already in the binary somewhere at some offset, like maybe binsh or something is there somewhere. But if not, you should still be able to do this. Instead of doing the A times 20, what if I said something like, well, I want the string slash bin slash sh. And that right there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bytes. So we could try entering that in a bunch of times or similar. Maybe if we can point the return pointer, or not the return pointer, the what was the environment variable argument, but just the argument system. If we can give it the proper address that's somewhere in memory of a useful string, then we should be able to do that remotely. In your challenge, so we're going to flip forward a little bit, where it says your turn, it's on slide 121, it says run and return the libc attack to print out and save the etc shadow file, and then use the unshadow tool to put password and shadow back together, then use John the Ripper to crack the password for Uber admin. And that's going to be your goal. But I will show you one funny thing that might occur. So let's say I try it out this way. I say create an environment variable. So I'll say export. I'll call it cat equals cat slash etc slash shadow. And I'll say and put that into a file called temp slash shadow. So that's my goal, is to copy the contents of etc shadow into temp. And I create that. Then we run env against cat and we get that address. So I bring my input here, and all I'm going to do is change this environment variable address to the new one, which is bffffae in my case. And you can see it says hado not found. Well, we know where that is because I said etc shadow. So hado is part of that. So if we start backing this up and say we go to A8 and it says permission denied. Well, doesn't that sound like I must not have the permission to do what I'm trying to do? Well, what you probably are trying to do is you're landing in the wrong spot. If you look at the string, echo, dollar sign, cat, if you're just trying to execute etc shadow, well, it's not executable. So it's going to say permission denied. There's some kind of permission. You're just not back far enough. And if we start backing up even further, look what might happen. So A6, I'll go back to A5. And it says garbled time, because what it's executing now is at etc shadow. So it's trying to do an at command. If you back it up one more, and now it just says seg fault. Let's see if we've got a temp shadow file. And there you can see we've got it. So that's going to be your goal, is to copy etc shadow and unshadow it and use John the Ripper to crack the Uber admin password. And all those instructions and everything are, of course, in the course materials. The last thing I'll say here before we finish up this module with an intro to return-oriented programming is this technique, return to libc, came out in the early 2000s from a security researcher called Solar Designer. And it kind of is what led us into return-oriented programming. And by what I mean by that is we're reusing code that happens to be in the process. Well, in this first example, when we return back, it's crashing because we're only executing one command. But what if we could return back to yet another call to system? Let me draw this out for you. So I'm going to draw the stack again. And we'll just write a quick buffer. I'll just be sloppy here. And then this was the save frame pointer. And then a return pointer. What we did in this last one, we overwrote the return pointer system. And then we had a 4-byte pad. And then we had our argument to system. And when it returns the pad and crashes. What if we don't do that? What if we return here to system again? So the return pointer is actually the address of system a second time. And then we have our argument. and that goes to the first call to system. Then it returns to system, and it would expect to pick up its next argument accordingly. So see how we can chain two of those libc calls together. Now, the problem here is, what if we wanted to chain a third? Well, too bad, because you're going to return back to the address of the argument, and it's going to crash. So there's a cool little trick you can do, which is what leads us into the return-oriented programming thing. And that is, instead of returning to system again, we're going to return to this little gadget. I'll just put G, I'll explain what a gadget is soon, but G-A-D-G-E-T, gadget. It's going to be a pointer to code that says pop into a register like EBP, followed by a ret. And let me draw this up, and then it'll make complete sense. This argument here goes to that first call to system. Then look what happens when we return. When we return to the address of the gadget, the stack pointer points to that argument, that old argument. Well, this pop is going to pop it off of the stack and tell the stack pointer to move down four more bytes, and then we return to whatever's there. Well, guess what we're going to put there? System. And then we point it to the gadget again, followed by the argument. And that goes to that call to system. And then when the stack pointer goes down, we return back to the gadget, it pops the old argument off the stack. And then we can just chain this together and do it as many times as we want. So it's pretty neat. And that's getting more into return-oriented programming. I'll quickly demo this just so you can see it. So to do this, I'm going to create three environment variables. So export, I'll call it echo one, and that's going to be equals cat, or actually echo hello. So we've done that. I'm going to do the same thing again, but this time it's going to be echo two, and then one more time, class, and then I'll call that echo three. Now I'm going to chain together three return to libc calls, and each one's going to be for the first echo, then the second echo, then the third echo. And if this all works, we should have hello there class printed out in succession, but only if it works. So to craft this up, I'm going to pull up my old input. So here's the old input. And so we've already got the address of system. What I need to do though is find a pop ret. And I'm just going to do a real quick way of finding this. I'm going to use object dump to disassemble the binary, and I'm going to grep for the instruction I want. So to do that, we'll say obj dump minus d for disassemble, and then the program name is passlibc, and then we'll say grep, and we'll say pop ebp, and then minus a1, so show me the instruction after as well. And there you can see we found a few instances of pop and then a ret afterwards. So I can use any one of these addresses, and I'll use the top one. So 804.8433. So let's bring our old input up, and let's craft this out. Right there, we've got the A times 20 getting to the return pointer, and that's the address of system. Then instead of putting pad, we're going to put this address of the pop ret. So let's get that ready. And actually, before we get started here, we need to get the address of the environment variables. So let's do that. So env echo 1, echo 2, and then echo 3. We've got those addresses. Then we'll pull up our old input and get this going. So there's the address of system. Then we're going to put in that pop ret address, which is going to be hex 33840408. And then plus our first environment variable on here, which is bffffe20. Now we need to subtract 10 from that. It's typically 10 off. So we can drop back down to 10, but then we need to add 6 because it's base 16. So 16 in this case. So hex 16 feffbf. And then we're going to put the address of system in again and the gadget address again. So I'll copy that. Paste it over. Then we're going to put in the second environment variable. So if we go 5B down to 4B and then add 6, where are we at there? So B, C, D, E, F, 0, 1. So I'm hoping it's 6, 1. 6, 1, F, E, and I might make a mistake. We'll fix it. B, F. Then we put in the address of system again. We're only chaining three together, so I don't care if we crash on the last one. So I'm going to put the system address in and then just pad. It'll just crash at the end. And then our final environment variable address, 48. So if we subtract 16 from that, we're at 38 plus 6. So 8, so 9, A, B, C, D, E. So we'll do 3E. And I'm just going to cross my fingers here that this is right on the first try. We get hello class. So we're so close here. Did I mix up the order or something? Let's see. So my first environment variable, BFFFE16. Second one is BFFFFE61. And the last one, BFFFFE3E. So let's look up here. Looks like only the middle one had a problem. We got the first and last one. So 5B, where are we at there? So 5B, I went the wrong direction, didn't I? So 5-1 instead of 6-1. And there we go. Hello there, class. So I just did a little bit, miscalculated my math there. But we chained three together. We got hello there, class. So just a fun little challenge to do, and that leads us into return-oriented programming. Let's go back out to the slide. So ROP stands for, again, return-oriented programming. It's a successor to return the libc-style attacks. Havav Shasham is the individual who kind of first publicly documented the technique. It can be multi-stage, which is typically how we use it. That means we get control of the instruction pointer, and we're up against something like data execution prevention. So we use return-oriented programming to set up the arguments and such and the call to a critical function like virtual protect to change permissions in memory where our shellcode resides, and then we return back out. So that's kind of how we typically use ROP, but we can really do anything with it. Turing complete, probably not so much, but what that would imply is that there are no limits. Like every single code sequence that we could ever want is in this process, and we know where everything is, and we can do anything. We can compile code on the fly is basically what we're doing by using code reuse. There's also jump-oriented programming, which instead of using the RET instruction, we can use things like jumps and pops and all to maintain control a different way, and we'll get back to that soon. So I've been using this word gadget. Gadget is nothing more than a sequence of code in executable memory followed by a return instruction or a jump instruction, some way for us to keep control. So you have to imagine all over memory, there are these code sequences that are probably meaningful to us. Now, it's unlikely that the code to enable a user, to create a user account, is going to be all together for us magically. So what we're trying to do is chain together the pieces of the code and string that along, and we're creating a ROP chain by doing that. A ROP chain is a string of gadgets all together. So we want to string together these pointers to these code sequences to achieve some overall goal, like adding a user account or popping a shell. The good thing about x86 and x64 is that it's an extremely dense architecture and instruction set. So we're not held and bound to any specific length for instructions. Like some architectures, like MIPS or something, for example, might have double word boundary aligned instructions. They've got to be all a double word. But in x86, as you saw earlier, there's 1 byte opcodes, 2 byte, 3 byte, and beyond. So that means we can index into any offset within a code sequence or opcode bytes, and it will interpret whatever's at that offset as a unique instruction or opcode. And I'll be able to explain this a little bit more on the next slides here. So this is a really contrived example, but you get the point. If we go at the beginning of that sentence up there, there's no punctuation or capitalization or delimiters. It says, what is the address of the party tonight? Because I want to make sure I do not arrive before all the other guests. That's the intended sentence to be read. But if we get control, like if we start at the beginning where the W is, the what, that's the intended meaning. But imagine if you index in 1 byte and we get to hat is the address of the party. It still reads, it's a little weird, but it reads, if we go in 2 bytes, it's at is the address of the party tonight. If we go in another byte, it's tis the address of the party tonight. Then is the address of the party tonight. And then finally, STSIF, which is an illegal instruction, is what you would get. But it's pretty fascinating that it worked all the way up until that offset. Not only that, if we look inside of that sentence at various points, you can see that other words that were never intended to be read or said are at different offsets. It says soft. Soft was never meant to be said. Art was never meant to be said. Part by itself was never meant. So there's all these words in here that aren't part of the real sentence. But if we have control of the instruction pointer, we can index into any offset and we can build a new sentence. Like in this example, it says her art is real. So we can create a whole nother sentence. That's again a contrived example, but you get the point. It works well as an analogy. Here's a real example. So if you look up at the very top here at this memory address, 7C8016CC, there's those opcodes, 8B45 and then 20. Those opcodes, when disassembled, result in move into EAX, dereference some stack offset. And then below it's compare EAX to EBX. That's what the process wants to do. Now notice in the second line, it says 3BC3. C3 by itself is the RET instruction. So if we were to point instead of to 6CF to 6D0, as you can see in the bottom example, it interprets that as a RET instruction. That's not what the process wanted to do though. But if we get control of the instruction pointer, we can point it anywhere we want, and as long as it's meaningful code and it ends with the return instruction, a way for us to maintain control, then we should be okay. So in that top line, if we change it from 16CC to 16CD, so we just index in 1 byte to the 45, see in the bottom how it completely changes the way that that code is interpreted. And now ends with a RET. That's the idea behind a ROP gadget finder or tool. It would go through executable memory looking for C3 bytes because it knows that that's a RET. And then it would iterate backwards at some depth that you would set. And it would see if I go back 3 bytes from the C3, does it end as a return? If I go back 4 bytes, does it still end as a return? And sometimes it will and sometimes it won't. Anytime that it does, that could be a useful code sequence. So you'd want to have a tool that would go through and find the thousands and thousands of C3 opcodes and find code sequences or gadgets that you could use. And then you string those together to accomplish some goal. So that's kind of the idea behind the whole thing. So ROP without returns, Havaf Shasham and Stephen Checkaway released a paper on this. The idea is instead of relying on return instructions all the time, what if instead we pop off the stack the address we want to jump to of the gadget, and then we jump to that register? That'd be more like jump-oriented instead of return-oriented. So it's because it's using the jump instruction. And the reason you might want to do that, there could be a potential ROP mitigation, exploit mitigation control that's looking for indications that someone's got a ROP chain there. I'll give you an example. If we call a function, the next address down is going to be the return pointer, right? So when we return back from the called function, we should expect to see the call to the function from which we are returning directly above it, right? Well, what if they added a little control that says before you allow a return pointer to be, before you allow redirection of execution to wherever the return pointer is pointing, validate that wherever we're returning to, above that is a call instruction. Because if it's not, then how would that have been a return pointer? You see the point there. So if we move over to jump-oriented programming, instead of using return, we could pop off the stack the address of the next gadget we want to have executed and then jump to the address in that register. So just an example. So that gets us to the end of that module there. We're going to stop with return-oriented programming until Book 5, and then you've got a long exercise with ROP. And it's quite challenging and fun to work your way through. Okay, welcome back. We're going to get started on advanced stack smashing now. So for this module, there's quite a few walkthroughs that I want to cover, and there's also an exercise. So just to kind of quickly go into it, we are going to first look at stack canaries and how you'd go about dealing with them. Are there ways that you can get around them? What are they? So on and so forth. Then we're going to take a look at an example of bypassing ASLR, a technique that you might be able to use. Then we've got an exercise on 64-bit stack smashing, and I'll walk through that one, and then you'll, of course, do the exercise. And then we'll finish up with one last ASLR example. So three out of these four are walkthroughs where I'll be demonstrating them, as opposed to just looking at the slides. And then the final one you'll be doing as well, and that's the 64-bit stack smashing one. After that, when we finish it up, we get to the boot camp or extended hours. As you can see on the screen, there are three options for you. One is a brute forcing ASLR approach. And then we have that bonus exercise, which is return to libc with ASLR on to deal with getting around ASLR that way. So all in all, we look at about four different techniques that you may or may not be able to use to get around ASLR. And you'll also have a boot camp exercise, something called MBSE, which is a open source application that has a buffer overflow vulnerability in it that you can play around with and get code execution there as well. So what I'll do is walk through the examples in this module in detail and get them working and show you. And I'll demonstrate the walkthrough for the 64-bit one. You'll do that one. And then for the bootcamp, I'll go into a lot of detail introducing them and how they work and what you're expected to do. And then those will be on your own to work through. That being said, you are absolutely encouraged to go back through any of the walkthroughs that I cover in this section. And even on the capture the flag, you may see a couple things appear. I'll give you one example. The canary bypass that I'll demo here, there is a challenge on the CTF that has you do that. So absolutely, you should take a shot at the walkthroughs as well. And I know I didn't say this earlier in the course, or at least I don't believe I did, but one of the things when we looked at why is this an extended hours course, why is it a bootcamp course, and I gave examples such as, well, we don't want to rush you in class, and if you need more time, you can have more time in the extended hours. We wanted to give you some things to reinforce the material. There really, though, is it's probably not possible on a lot of these days to get through everything because there's so much content to cover, but I'd rather give you too much, and so that way you can take it home or work on it after hours. Then give you too little and you get done super quick. You want to learn. So it's definitely a great idea to go back through all this stuff and run it through multiple times, especially if you're going to go and work on taking the GXPN exam that goes with this course, because there will be some practical exam components in there where a virtual machine will be coming up through your browser and you'll be asked to do some of these techniques on the target system to prove that you're able to do them. And those count as questions that are worth a lot of points for the exam. And I think that's a great thing that GX does there. All right, so let's get moving forward. So Linux stack protection, what is it? On Linux, they call them canaries. On Windows, they call them security cookies, which I think is a terrible name because you think of cookies and you think of web stuff. But a security cookie on Windows is the same thing as a canary anywhere else. And the idea is there a way that we can protect the return pointer and other variables on the stack from an overwrite? Now, maybe not protect them from being overwritten, but we can make it so if we've detected that something has been overwritten, we can terminate the process. That's kind of the idea behind a canary. And I'm going to jump forward a couple slides, and then we'll go back so I can point this out real quickly. On slide 136 here, you see it says buffer, then canary, then save frame pointer, return pointer. So that new variable shows up called the canary. There's different ways that can be represented, and that's what we're going to walk through, but that's kind of where it sits. And if you overwrite the return pointer, you would have had to overwrite the canary. And if the canary doesn't look right during the epilogue, the process won't let you get to the return instruction. It'll throw an exception. So going back, common types of stack protection. Stack smash and protector was what we're going to use today. It's still what's used by the GNU C compiler. So that's what you're going to be up against, and we'll see that shortly. Formerly known as ProPolice, supports different types of canaries. What you want is random canaries, but sometimes they're not always available, and you may use Terminator canaries, so we'll talk about both. StackGuard is the older version, and it used a Terminator canary. So there's three primary canary types: terminator, random, and null. Random's the one you want from a security perspective. So look at the null canary on the bottom. Now imagine you overrun a buffer and you overwrite the return pointer, but in order to get there, you had to overwrite that canary, and it's 4 bytes of zeros. Well, you could say, well, I know what the canary is, so can't I just repair it as part of my input? Well, that's why they're using null bytes, because they know a lot of memory copy operations or functions can't write nulls. So you wouldn't be able to fix the canary that way. Same thing with terminator canary. Some functions can't write nulls, but other functions can't write other bytes. Like, for example, we'll see in the 64-bit challenge coming up in a little bit that there's a function used that can, it can write nulls, but it can't write 0A. So you might see something like that. I believe gets is a function that does that. I'm trying to think real quickly of the function that we're going to see here coming up soon that doesn't let us write the 0A byte. It's the read function, the read. So read doesn't let you write 0A. So that's why they use those special byte values, because different functions have different limitations, is the point. So that's null and terminator. And again, you as the attacker, you know what the canary is in that case, but you're going to have a hard time repairing it because those special values are being used. The best one is a random canary, and that is a value that would be unknown to the attacker. And in this case, it'd be 32 bits, or if it's 64-bit, it could be 64 bits. It's going to be hard to guess that random value. Now, only one canary is typically created per process invocation. In other words, if you run a start up an application and it's running, there's going to be a canary that's created at runtime that's used for the duration of that process. Now, when you terminate the process and start it back up again, a new random canary will be generated. The reason we don't create random canaries per every function call, and maybe not every function call will even get a canary, is because it's overhead, right? It's going to slow the process down. So how does a compiler choose which function calls get a canary or not? It used to be very simple in that they would say, if there's a string buffer associated with the function call, then put a canary there, otherwise don't. But in more modern compilers, they got a little more aggressive with them because mistakes were made. So that's a high-level overview of the different canary types there. The one that we're going to look at bypassing is the terminator canary in this first example. But before we do that, I want to show you how you might approach going after a random canary. Now, you might have a memory leak or something that's allowing you to view the internals of the process, and you can find it out that way. But let's assume that you don't have a memory leak. I'll go back over to my paint here so we can draw this out. So I'm just going to draw a stack. And let's say we've got a buffer up top. The very top is your buffer. And then we've got this canary up next. And let's pretend that the random canary just happened to be 03040202. Just making it simple. After that, then, would be the frame pointer, if applicable. After that would be the return pointer. Our goal, of course, being to hijack the return pointer there. But we've got to be able to repair this random canary. Now, this isn't always going to work. But if it's a threaded application or process, or a parent process that forks and creates a child process, which inherits the parent canary, I'm going to say parrot canary, huh? If it inherits the parent's canary, then we might be able to try over and over again to guess, to brute force what the canary value is, because it's not terminating the parent process. So let's say the buffer is 16 bytes. We could say, I want to send in A times 16, and then plus, I'm just going to go after the first byte of the canary there, or I guess the last, depending on how you look at it, which is 02, but I don't know that. So my first attempt is going to be send in slash x 01, and it says, nope, you killed the process, or the child process. So then we do it again, but this time we try slash x 02, and it says, no problem, you got it right. we're only going after one byte at a time as opposed to going after the whole thing at once. Because going after 2 to the 32nd power versus 2 to the 8th power 4 separate times is going to be obviously better. We want to go after the smaller portion. So let's say we get the last byte of the canary correct. Then we'd say, okay, 02 plus hex 01. And it says, no, wrong. So then we send in hex 02. And then hex 02 again, and we get it right. So we know we got the second last bytes of the canary. And then we do the same thing. We go 1, 2, 3, 4 and try to get that next one, and we'd eventually be able to brute force this pretty quickly. Now again, it's not something you're always going to be able to do, but it's something you might be able to do and something to keep in mind. The idea is that you don't want to act like any one of these exploit mitigations is going to stop you from being successful. That any one of them might be, you might be able to bypass them or defeat them somehow or avoid them. That's why from a security perspective, you want to utilize as many of these mitigations as possible because it's going to make the life of the attacker much more difficult. Okay, so I'm going to use my Kubuntu Gutsy Gibbon VM for this one. And let's go over to the target. And there's this program called Canary on here. And when we run it, it says usage, username, password, and PIN. So I say, okay, username AAAA, password BBBB, and PIN is CCCC. And it says authentication failed. So this time I change the first argument to a bunch of A's. And we hit enter. And look at that new message that's appeared. Stack smashing detected. That is the message from SSP. That's a compiler inserted control. So the developer doesn't have to worry about this. A compiler inserts the canary code. So what we want to do is take a look at what the canary code is doing to see what we're up against here. But you can see that new message has appeared. So let's go in with GDB and take a look. So disassemble the main function. And we can see that the main function calls a function called testfunc. So we'll say disassemble testfunc. Now, if you look at the very top here, this is the canary code. I'm highlighting it right now. It says move GS segment register offset 20 into the accumulator register and then write the value in the accumulator register to -4 from the base pointer. That is the code that's placing the canary onto the stack. And we can set a breakpoint there and we can take a look and see what the canary is. So the canary is stored at GS offset 14 or 20. And then if we go to the very bottom, here's where the canary check is being made, right here. So it says move what's stored at -4 from the base pointer into EDX, and then XOR what's in EDX against offset 20 from the GS segment register. So that's checking to see if the canary has been modified. And then it says jump if equal. So if equal, go and do the epilogue and ret out. If not equal, call the stack check fail function. So pretty simplistic code. I've actually written custom code for this and capture the flag challenges before because it's so easy to do. And that's why it's fast. So let's go back up to the top and we'll set the breakpoint accordingly. I'm going to set it right when we're moving from GS into EAX. So break, paste that in. And we'll say run AAAA BBBB CCCC. Breakpoint has been hit. Look at the instruction here. And it says move what's stored at GS offset 14X into EAX. So right now on EAX, info reg EAX is that. If we say step one instruction, look what's there now. So that's a terminator canary we saw on the slide. 00000AFF. And that's what we'd be up against. That's what we'd have to repair. And then that's going to get checked, as you saw in the epilogue later on. Now, if you look at this function again, you could see there's a call to stir copy right there. And then there's a second call to stir copy. And then there's a third call to stir copy. Now, let's take a look at that. I believe I showed in book 3 an example of a IDA Python script. And we looked at Sophos antivirus. Let's take one more look at that just in case it got missed or you've forgotten. So I'm going to go over to this Windows 7 VM. Let me just revert back to the right snapshot that I want to get to. Let's go to, yeah, it's fine. So we'll give it a moment to revert. And then I'm going to bring up IDA. We're going to load Sophos Antivirus. Either way, I'm going to bring up IDA. This again being the interactive disassembler, and I'm going to bring up Sophos Antivirus. Give me a moment. All right. So we've loaded Sophos Antivirus in. And there's that script again, the banned functions one. And we run that, I run it twice, it sets the breakpoint back on. And if you look at the bottom left, you can see that we found calls to dangerous functions like strcpy and strcat. So if we go up and look to see how many times strcpy's been called, it's over 10 times right there that I'm highlighting on the screen. So over 10 times strcpy's being called inside this antivirus main engine. So if we want to go directly to one of those spots, I just double click on one of them. And what I'm showing here is a block of, this is one block of code within a function within Sophos Antivirus. And you can see strcpy and strcat are called multiple times within the same function. And if we scroll up a little bit higher, it's called again right there. There's strcpy again. The reason I'm showing this to you is because the requirement that's going to allow us to successfully exploit this vulnerability or exploit the fact that there's a Terminator canary and repair it is due to the fact that strcpy is called three times. And I just wanted to recap and show you an example because I know I remember some folks in the past saying, well, what's the chance, what's the likelihood that there's going to be three calls to strcpy within a single function? Well, there's an example of an antivirus product doing it. So hopefully that adds some reality into this. So it's actually a possible technique as opposed to something that's way too conditional. So what we want to do is see what kind of, well, we saw what kind of Terminator canary it was. We want to set breakpoints on each call to strcpy and start trying to repair this thing to see if we can get it going. So first, let's do that. Let's set the breakpoints after each call to strcpy. So here's the first one, 804.8469. And I set it after the call because I want strcpy to have already executed. I don't want to break on strcpy and watch it execute the code. So we'll say break, paste that in, and then we're going to look at the next two. So the next one is going to be 804.847b, or, yep. So break on that address, and then finally 804.848d, paste that in, and I'm going to get rid of that first breakpoint, which was the breakpoint on the canary generation. So we'll say delete break one. Info break, I should have three more left. There's two, three, and four after each call to strcpy. Now, if you look at the code, let me bring it back up again. You can see the difference. So it says like move, let's see here. Load the effective address FFFFFFE4. And then above that, it says load the effective address FFFFFFEC. So each buffer for the strcpy call is only 8 bytes. And we can validate that here in a moment, but that's, we just easily figured that out. And we want to go and try to just repair it without having to do anything weird. It's not going to work, but at least let's just try it, right? So in order to do that, I'm going to say, I'm going to jump out to the slide. I always forget the echo syntax. We're going to use echo. We could use Python and stuff, but they have problems with the bytes like 0a and 0d potentially. So we'll just use echo. So I need a quote backtick apostrophe. So quote backtick apostrophe apostrophe backtick quote. And you'll see why we use this in a second. And we'll say run. And then A, that's the first buffer to get us to the save frame pointer, or the canary actually. And here I'm just going to try and repair the canary manually. And it's not going to work, but we'll try. So echo minus E, and then /x00000AFF. After that, I'm going to put SSSS for the save frame pointer, then RRRR for the return pointer. Then we go ahead and let that close out. And then I'll put my second argument and then my third argument. So that whole echo command is the first argument and then our second argument and third argument. And we're just trying to repair the canary manually. So let's see what happens. We run it. We hit the first breakpoint, x/20x ESP. And you can see it, it doesn't look so good. In fact, let's try to run it without trying to repair the canary so that we can see what it looks like normally. So run AAAA, BBBB, CCCC. We hit that first breakpoint to start copy. And here you can see the canary. So right there, FF0A0000. And there's a return pointer a couple bytes over. Remember, we can always say BT to see the return pointer. 804.8517, 804.8517. So to the left of that is a save frame pointer. To the left of that is the canary. To the left of that is the buffer, and we can see our four A's copied in there. So let's send in our input again. And we're trying AAAAAAA, and then echo minus E, and then 00000AFF. So let's run that again. Take a look at the stack. And you can see things don't look so good. In fact, it looks really screwed up, almost like something's wrong with my syntax. Let me just double check this and correlate it with the slide here. Not that all looks right. Apostrophe, that's a quotation mark, backtick, apostrophe. What do I have it? Ah, so I missed my syntax up a little bit. Happens all the time. So let's change this to a quote. Change that to an apostrophe. This might be wrong again. I'm going to validate here. Backtick apostrophe. Okay, so it looks good. And let's run this. Now look what happened. There's the canary position. You could see it's like it's a partially fixed canary. It's like it's almost, if it was a real bird, we pretty much mangled it. It's like missing a wing or something. But, you see 53FF0A20. We need it to be FF0A0000. Well, first off, that 20 right there is a space in my syntax. So let me get rid of that and see what happens. Run it again. So now we've got 5353FF0A. What's weird is if you look at my input, I'm sending in 00000AFF. Where are the 00s going? It's like completely ignoring them. So they're not being very useful. We need to push this FF0A over a couple bytes, and then we need to get those null bytes next to it. So I'm going to go ahead and get rid of the zeros because they're not doing any good. And we'll just put AA there for 2 bytes of padding. Now we take a look. So you can see we've got half the bird is repaired, and then the other half is mangled here. We need that to be 0000, and currently it's 4141. And then we've got our save frame pointer, and then we've got our return pointer. So how are we going to go about doing this? Well, obviously I'm going to go back to the fact that stir copy is being used. If we continue, we just let the second argument get written onto the stack. That's the second stir copy call. And you can see the difference. Now we've got 4242, 4242. But look up at that position before we let that occur. That would be right above the canary there. It was a 01, and now it's BBBB. Next to it was BFFF F91F, and now it's BFFF F900. Why is that the case? Because stir copy null terminated zeros into that position. So watch what happens if we add in four more Bs. We'll let that go, continue, and take a look. Now look what it did. It null terminated the null byte into the first argument that was written onto the stack. So if we push it four more bytes, BBBB, and take a look this time, you can see we now pushed it all the way down to the next double word down. If we push it five more bytes, we should be able to push that null byte right to that precise position in the canary field. So let's do that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And continue. See how we were able to repair another one of those bytes of the canary that way. And the fact that there's a third stir copy call coming is going to allow us to repair that final byte there. We just need to make sure that we put in the right number of C's in this case. So there our C's got written. There's the four of them. We need to write 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 24. 24 bytes in the third argument should null terminate in the appropriate canary position. So CCCC, so I think that's 24, we'll find out. So here's before the third argument writing, and here's after. So you can see we repaired the canary completely, and if we continue, we no longer get the stack smashing detected. Error message. We're able to repair that and get control of the return pointer. So that pretty much demonstrates the point and purpose here, but let's take it all the way home and let's get shellcode execution. I'm going to drop down to a shell. I'm going to cat out our shellcode file. This time we're going to take this silly shellcode here that says shellcode for ASCII moo. And we'll copy that. Go back in our debugger. And this time we're going to put our shellcode after the return pointer. I'm going to put a short nop sled in so we can find things. Put 8 nop bytes in, paste in our shellcode, and let that continue. All right, so let's look at the stack. So here's the nop sled right past the return pointer overwrite of ours. So we just need to overwrite the return pointer then with an address in the nop sled so that it will then execute our shellcode. So dep is not on in this case. We're just looking at the canary right now. So we'll go and take BFFFF6B4 in this case. So we'll execute 4 nops. Let's pull that up. And I'll change the Rs and the return pointer position to that. So B4, F6, FF, BF. And we executed our shellcode. So we see we're able to, under the right conditions, potentially bypass or repair or get around the whole canary thing. In this case, the command execution was just to run apt get moo. It's a little Debian Easter egg. All right, so that gets us through the canary section here in stack prevention section. So a real-world example of that where you had to repair the canary is with ProFTPD, which is a popular FTP server on Linux. And in that particular vulnerability, you had to repair the Terminator canary. And in that particular case, you could actually just write it because the vulnerable function involved let you just write the canary, so it's a little easier. But then also, you had to get around ASLR. And the way they got around ASLR is the next technique we're going to walk through.